All right, and welcome everyone to another Wednesday night Cancel the Cabal on People's Internet Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts, and tonight's going to be a very special guest. I've got what he calls himself a expatriated American. He lives in Japan right now. I guess I could bring up his bio, but Sean already did that for me, so thanks, Sean. An Unlikely Truth author, John Rachel. John Rachel has a BA in philosophy, has traveled extensively, is a songwriter, music producer, novelist, a left-of-left liberal, and has spent his entire life trying to resolve the intrinsic clash between the metaphysical party of Buddhism and the overwhelming appeal of narcissism. Now that sounds interesting to me. Prompted by the trauma of his graduating high school and leaving and having to leave his beloved city of Detroit to attend university, the development of his social skills and worldview were arrested at the age of 18. This affliction figures prominently in his creative work. So, welcome to the show, John.
Well, thank you. Thanks for reading. That's my little tongue-in-cheek bio. And that's the revision you have. Okay.
Well, this is crazy, John. You're
I was primping in front of a mirror and trying to get our hair just perfectly.
Huh? I said, this is crazy because your Skype started going a little wacko there for a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Start back at the beginning there.
I said, I think we're all struggling to try to resolve the appeal of narcissism. I mean, we spend hours, you know, primping our hair and making ourselves look good for whoever. Anyway, yeah, that's my tongue-in-cheek bio.
Okay. Okay. Well, you're from the same state that I am. I'm just on the other side of the state originally. John, mm-hmm. Go ahead and explain to us a little bit more what is not in the bio.
Well, I grew up in Detroit area, and actually I'm from the same, I went to high school in the same town as Eminem, if you want to put any kind of celebrity on it, Warren, Michigan.
Right, right.
And you know, I'm a Midwestern guy. I have the basic values of Midwestern people, which I think are really good people, you know. We just basically want to have a decent life and raise our families and maybe have a little brighter future for them than we had. I had a pretty bleak past. I mean, my parents were very poor. I lived in a trailer, lived in a very industrialized part of Detroit, and there were factories all around my high school. So I know that side of life, and I know that America is the wealthiest country in the world. So I started to ask myself early in life, why is it throughout my whole life? My parents died when I was 14, both of them. So I ended up working in a factory while I was in high school. I ended up working in factories even while I was in at university. And I've always wondered about why it is that the wealth, the great wealth of America, isn't more fairly distributed. So some people now would say, oh, that's you must be a communist or a socialist. No, actually, I'm just a guy from Michigan who wants his fair share. And as I've traveled the world, I see that this is really the struggle that kind of defines the entire 7 billion people that live on Earth. You know, whether you go to communist Vietnam or you go to Slovenia, where I was last summer, people are just want their fair share. And it's interesting. I noticed that on your Skype, you have the byline, if you repeat a big lie often enough, it becomes ingrained as a truth. And I think the big lie that's being told to everyone in the world, and especially the people in America, is that we really don't have access and don't deserve our fair share of the enormous affluence that is available to us. When I left America in 2006, we were under the rule of King George, and everybody was extremely frightened of terrorism. And we were told that towel heads were going to come jumping out from the bushes and from under the rocks and attack us. And of course, that's not happened. I mean, that's one of those big lies that we were told. And now we're being told, for example, that the Ukraine, oh my God, what's going to happen in the Ukraine? We have to start putting troops and missiles and so forth because the big bear Russia is going to attack us. And then we're told, oh, China, oh my God, another scary big country is going to attack us. And now we have ISIS. Now, the department analysts in the NSA have said there's no threat to America by this. It's a crazy group that, by the way, we created. But we're being told the big lie that ISIS is the latest excuse for us going to war.
Yeah.
It's another big lie, which in the end comes down to, sorry, we can't afford to put decent schools in your communities. We can't afford to repair the bridges that are falling down. We can't afford to really let you, the American people, have your fair share because we need to spend a lot of money on military. We need to give a lot of money to other countries to fight our battles. So you don't get your fair share. It all comes down to that question of where does the wealth go? And this is the question that I think people say politics, you know, I don't get it. I don't see where it's connected to me. Well, it is connected to you. You go look at your bank account, you've only got $23 in there. That's politics working in your life. That's the life that you've been handed of a very tiny elite of oligarchs. When I lived in Warren, Michigan, with the trailer parks, I used to drive my old clunker car over to a place called Bloomfield Hills and a place called Birmingham, where there were these sprawling mansions, and they sent their kids to Cranbrook Institute. I couldn't even afford to go there for one day, much less a whole year. That's politics. Politics protecting a very tiny elite group of people that own 90% of the wealth in America, and you and I get to struggle and argue over the scraps. So that's how politics works. The big lie serves this master class of people, and it will continue to serve them as long as we believe the lie and as long as we continue to be indifferent to politics. So my book, An Unlikely Truth, I'm not trying to sell books here, but contains my approach for attacking the problem. And my approach for attacking the problem is not left, right. It's not socialist or libertarian or anything. It's called democracy. It's saying, you know what? Both of the major parties are lying to us. We need to get some independent candidates in there. We need to get people from the communities where we live into Washington, D.C., and fighting for us. That's all the book is about. Yes, it is from the standpoint, my main character is a Green Party candidate and so forth. But if you look at the Green Party platform, it's basically a platform for the people. It says, let's get a decent wage. Let's protect the environment. Let's do the right thing for the people of America, not the tiny 0.1% of oligarchs that now run things. So in that book, I propose a method, community by community, of deciding what's best for that community and then locking candidates, locking the representatives that we elect into a legal contract to go to Washington and do what we tell them to do. If they don't sign the contract, they don't get the vote. It's that simple. Finland, I know I'm carrying on, but I'm just giving examples. Finland has a really interesting system. Their legislature is not full of political experts. It's not a political class. People in their legislature are teachers. They're people like you. They're people like me that have worked regular jobs. When they're elected to go to serve for their government, their job is held for them. So when they come back after 2 years, their job's waiting for them. They have regular people running their country. It's not too complex. They tell us all the time, oh, it's just too difficult. These issues are too complex. No, they're not too complex. The questions are fair wages, minimum wage. Do we go to war? Do we give equal rights to everybody? Do we have freedom of the press? Those are simple questions. Anybody in America can just do a little bit of reading and make an intelligent decision. We don't need the political class to tell us how to run the country. We can run our own country. That is the basis of our democratic system. So I say, fine, let's have people from each community. I'm sure you know people right in your own community who follow politics, who follow all this stuff, who could go to Washington and make and represent the people in your part of Michigan as well, if not better, than the person that's in office now. I should ask you, are you happy with your congressman? Do you have a good congressman?
Not at all.
Okay. Are the people in your community happy with that congressman?
A lot of them are caught in a matrix, so yes, they are. They're into the left-right paradigm.
See, that's the, and that's another big lie that's been used to divide people. But you know, what I did is I went and I looked at key issues. If you look at the key issues, there's certain defining issues, and they're not abortion. Yes, we have a big difference of opinion on them. They're not gay marriage. You get into the key issues, the one that affect your checkbook. Minimum wage. Something like 78% of Americans want a minimum wage of at least $10. I visit countries, you know, in Australia, the minimum wage is like $18 or something
18,
like
yeah,
that.
Well, yeah, the servers in the restaurants get like $17, $18 an hour.
So you have this vast majority of Americans who say, yes, we want a minimum wage. They send their congressman to Congress and the Congress votes against it. Now, something like 70%, now with this ISIS thing, I don't even know what the statistics are, but the Americans are being brainwashed on this, but most people do not want a boots-on-the-ground war in any part of the world. They don't want us in Pakistan or Iraq or Iran or any of these places. So
no,
we're
we
being
don't.
Lied to and said, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. We won't send your boys and girls to go fight that war. It's a big lie. Next year at this time, we will have more of our kids coming home in body bags. So anyway, most of the people do not want war. In fact, when we were talking about attacking Syria, there was finally the American public said, no more of this. We send our guys to Congress, and what did they do yesterday? They voted in support of giving more money to these good terrorists in the Middle East. There are no good terrorists. The good terrorists in the Middle East are a fantasy. The ISIS is fighting and killing and beheading people in that area with our money. That money was filtered through Turkey and through our allies, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. All these countries are arming them.
Ireland, too.
Huh?
Ireland also.
And Ireland. So the point is, Americans don't want war. We send our congressmen, they vote for war. So my and there's a whole bunch of issues. Higher taxes on the rich, a more equitable tax system like we used to have in the 50s and 60s. Simple thing, GMO labeling. You know, GMOs are not safe. There's a lot of research. People know that there's something amiss here, and it's all they want is they just want a label. They didn't say we have to ban them. We just want to know what's in our food. We pick up a package. It says so much vitamin A, so much vitamin B. It has mustard seed and soybean, this and that. But it doesn't say whether it has GMO in it. So 93% of Americans just want labeling. Can't get it through Congress. I say, if a congressman won't sign a contract, if a congressional candidate won't sign a contract that says, I will go to Congress and this is what I'll do, he doesn't get the vote. You'd be better off electing your taxi driver or your fireman or the guy that's running the 7-Eleven than putting these crooks back into office, because they're going to go to Washington and do the opposite of what the American public wants.
Well,
that's all my book is about. It just lays out as a story, which makes it a little easier to follow and I think more enjoyable to read. It lays out this plan for taking on the big money corporate lapdogs that we now have running the country.
It's interesting. In your bio, it happens to mention Buddhism and philosophy. Is that the main thing that you that you're all about?
No, not at all. In fact, I should have sent you the more serious. That was a kind of a tongue-in-cheek bio.
Okay.
Because every place I submit my writing, they always want a bio. So I just made that up as kind of a joke. But the interesting thing is, I was raised Catholic. I'm what's called a fallen Catholic because after my parents died and I saw the way the church dealt with that, I stopped going to church. That doesn't mean I'm not spiritual. It doesn't mean that I'm an atheist necessarily. But as I've traveled, it's interesting. The countries that I travel through that are where the people are the most, shall we say, gracious, typically are the Buddhist countries. Japan is a very materialistic country, very much like America. They love their cars and their fashions and their makeup and so forth. But it's basically a Buddhist country. And Buddhism, I'm not promoting it, but does create an interesting kind of social texture in these countries. So I've been in many Buddhist, even China. Basically, you go through China, there's Buddhist temples everywhere, in spite of the fact it's a communist country.
In Tibet, yeah. In Tibet.
So, I'm not saying that people should necessarily become Buddhist, but there's a lot of good things to be said about the Buddhist view of the world. But no, I'm not a Buddhist.
Well, there's just a lot of things that can be said about the someone who is more spiritual than religious, so to speak.
Everybody has spiritual experiences every day. You know. When you get up in the morning and your kids are still sleeping and you go and you look at their faces, that's a very spiritual experience. And if you open the window and the sun is coming up, that to me is a spiritual experience. I am very blessed in the sense that because of a lot of crises that came about in my life in the early 2000s, between 2001 and 2006, basically the music empire that I had built up fell apart. My personal life fell apart. My wife left me. And I was confronted with a decision. You know, what the hell am I doing? What am I doing with my life? And since King George was installed as our president through the second election, it seemed like America was going to be on this path of perpetual war, perpetual fear, and that the quality of life that I was experiencing there seemed to be in decline. I said, you know what? As a kid, I always wanted to travel. My earliest memories were going through books and going, wow, look at this, Austria and Germany and Africa and Asia. And so I packed everything up and I hit the road. I, 60 years old, I became a backpacker and I did something called woofing. Well, the short of this is that I am very, very blessed in that I've been able to go to 26 countries now since I left America. I've seen the Great Wall of China. I've seen some of the most beautiful and majestic things on our planet. And I have been, as a result, you know, backpacking all alone through and trekking through mountain passes and so forth. I have been able to experience a lot of what I would call spiritual experiences. They have nothing to do with prayer books and hymns or believing in the Pope or God or anything. It's just embracing the beauty that is available to all of us on Earth. And I thank, every day I thank God that I live in Japan. I live in a rural area. It's very peaceful. After this phone conversation, I'll do some business. I'll get on my bicycle and I'll ride through the village that I live in, and the Japanese people will all bow and konnichiwa. Good morning. And I have a very, very blessed life, and I thank God that I'm not in the midst of what many people are experiencing in America, which is a constant assault on their senses. It's an assault on their privacy. It's an invasion of the space that they need to just appreciate life. I read an article 2 weeks ago, I think it was, about a woman who was asphyxiated in her car because she was going between four jobs she was trying, having to work to survive in America. What kind? We're the richest country in the world, and a woman has to work four minimum wage jobs. She's so exhausted, she pulls over on the side of the road and very foolishly leaves her car running and dies from carbon monoxide. What kind of, that doesn't happen here. That doesn't even happen in Vietnam and India and places where I visit.
Well, I think that's because Americans are far more materialistic, and they want to have these shiny little trinkets, these little games that you can hold in your hand, and the $800 cell phones, the $2,000 computers, whether it be a Mac or something like that, or they have to have these $60,000 or $70,000 Lexus sitting in their front yard, John, and they also have to have the RV so they can go to their weekend home on the lake. I'm in the
Right
southwest.
itself, my friend. You know,
Yeah, I'm in
and it's
this.
amazing because most people can't afford that, so they put it on a credit card, right?
Yeah, or three or four or five. Yes.
Well, I used to live in a 16-room house in Portland, Oregon. I had my recording studio there, so, and I used to have before cell phones became the thing. I used to have a cell phone and 12 landlines in my office and five in my house, and I've had all that. I don't have a cell phone anymore. This computer I'm on right now, I bought used at a because couldn't you if you buy a used computer in Japan, it's like brand new because they're so meticulous about taking care of things. I don't know. Everybody has to find their own path to happiness. Maybe that is the message that has kind of seeped into my consciousness by traveling. I have a backpack, I have a fresh pair of shorts, three pair of underwear, and I'm sitting watching the sun go down behind the mountains, and I know that and somebody else is going driving from to four jobs so he or she can buy, I don't know what these games that you're talking about, I don't
Games,
know if
yeah.
important to people.
Flashy little trinkets, yeah.
Everybody has to make their own choices, But you know what? Let me defend that. There's no reason why everybody in America can't have all those trinkets if that's what they want. If that's what's important to them, there's no reason they can't. I mean, it's inconceivable to me that you could have a country with so much wealth as America has, and it doesn't filter down to everybody.
Yes. Just to kind of expand on that a little bit, I believe currently, maybe if I'm a little bit off here, but I think there's like 18 million vacant homes right now. Either people have left them, or have left them, or are in the process of leaving them because of foreclosures.
Right.
And there are like 4.5 million homeless people. So there are over three and a half to one homes per one home to one homeless person, and that just boggles my mind.
That is mind-boggling. Yes. What about health care? Everybody is talking. I'm not going to get into the whole thing about Obamacare, but I read a statistic yesterday, and I put it on Facebook. It says Obamacare working only 41 million people without health care insurance. Only 41 million. You know how many we have in Japan? Zero.
Zero people that are not on health care?
Yeah, everybody has. If
Yeah.
you are the poorest person in the world, you will still have health care
Sure.
here in Japan. You have it in Canada. You have it even in England and many. America's the only modern industrialized country in the world that doesn't have universal health care.
Even Gaddafi over there in Libya gave his people free health care. The people of Iran. I believe they get free health care, but they just don't have any. I think it's just government run is what it is over in them two states,
When the
countries.
whole health care debate started, and it started, well, I mean, it's been going on for decades, but way back even when in Clinton years when Hillary tried to reform it, and then again when Obama tried to reform it, the whole idea of single payer or a government-run system immediately taken off the table. And you say, why? Oh, they always say it's so inefficient and it'll take away, again, the big lie, because I'm in Japan and I know how healthcare can be. You know that if you're an American citizen, just a tourist, and you collapse in the airport or at a train station, you will immediately be taken into the state-of-the-art facility. The facilities are as good, if not better, than anything in America. You will be given the best care in the world. They will not ask for your insurance card. The first priority of the healthcare system is to save the patient's life here. Later on, they'll try to figure out where the money's coming. They don't care about that. They take care of you. They keep you alive. I've seen this happen. This is not a figment of my imagination. That's the way it should be. That is a country of people who care about other people. So you look at America, America be bragging about how great things are going now with 41 million, I'm just roughly calculating, what 12, 14% of the population still doesn't have health care insurance? That's absurd.
Yeah, there's like 330 million. So I'd have to get the calculator out to do that quickly.
And it's improving slowly, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, this has been going on all my life. So I didn't, even though I was a very successful businessman, I had some horrible healthcare program and something happened. I can't remember. I needed, you know, some minor procedure. And of course, you know, we sent the bill in and, oh, I'm sorry. This, if you look under clause 14/B-9, you'll see that it doesn't cover what happened to you. It's like this big game, you know. So America needs to decide what's important, and it needs to put its foot down. People can't make excuses anymore. This whole the cries for war is going to bankrupt the country.
Yes.
I'm not talking about the war in the Middle East. I'm talking about the war that America is preparing to launch on Russia. This is not talked about. This whole Ukraine thing is just one big smokescreen. The Ukraine crisis in the eastern Ukraine has been resolved. There is a ceasefire in place. There has been agreement between eastern Ukraine and Kiev, which is the capital of the entire country, to allow them a high degree of autonomy. So ask yourself, why is it that America and Europe is still imposing and talking about more sanctions on Russia? Why?
Yeah, that's a big question.
Well, it's very easily answered. Putin, I'm not saying I'm a Putin fan. I mean, the guy's a homophobe. He's got a lot of problems. But, you know, every leader, every country has their problems. But Putin has, for the most part, for the last decade, wanting to promote the Russian economy and trying to establish Russia as a positive force in the world, has basically been the peacemaker. He's the one who should have gotten the Nobel Peace Prize. He's the one who took the situation in Syria and turned it around so that America didn't end up dropping bombs. Putin and Obama were working together on a lot of things, and a lot of it was being kind of done behind the scenes. Well, the people that are actually determining American foreign policy are the neocons, the people that are behind the Project for a New American Century. They
Certainly.
Want war with Russia. And so
Certainly.
They are driving this whole thing to a crisis level so that America ends up in a confrontation with Russia. These people are, number one, crazy. Number two, they're delusional. Russia is a major, major power, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, and they're not going to let America overrun it the way that America overran Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well,
we are now on the precipice of a major confrontation with a nuclear-armed country that is not going to put up with any more with America's BS. And
well,
that's what's going on, and people don't really – this whole ISIS thing – and all the other distractions that are going on are taking people's attention away from the real crisis that we're facing, which is potentially World War III.
Yes, they are. Well, I think Obama is just as bad as Bush as ever was, John.
I think he's worse, you know, because he's such a good-looking guy.
Yeah.
He's got such charm. He's
well,
fun. He's a real salesman, and
He's a lot better speaker. His rhetoric is a lot more reformed than what George Bush's was. He's a lot more believable than what Bush was.
Hence more dangerous,
yeah. Well, with Bush, the patriotic community said that You knew that there was an iron fist of tyranny coming, but with Obama, you get the iron fist with a velvet glove over the top of it.
That's very good. You should write my books. You're doing a better job than me. That's good.
No, but I am really just mad at the anti-war left over here in America. They were so vocal from 2001 until 2009 when he got put in office, and they haven't nobody's heard a peep from them in the last 5 years. And that's what really makes me mad.
And the country is becoming so militarized. I mean, I don't know what it looks like in Niles, Michigan. Hopefully you don't have Humvees and SMAPs and all these other things there. But you look at the country from the outside where I do, the way I do, and it looks like a military state. And in a military state, dissent is not tolerated. And that's what it looks like to me. So even if your anti-war protesters were to go in the street, you're right, though. Why? Why is this? Where are they? Because when I was in Portland, even before the Iraq War, which I thought was, a complete and total fraud, we had a march in Portland, 20,000 people. That's a lot of people.
Yes, yes, it is.
Where are they?
Where are they? You don't hear much from Code Pink on CNN or MSNBC anymore.
Is it they're just being shut out? Is that what's happening? I mean, they're just...
I really don't know. Either that or they are in on the game and they're just being silent until a Republican gets the presidency next election. And then they'll suddenly become anti-war again. That's what I'm kind of thinking.
Mark my words, there will be a Republican in office the next time.
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you who it's going to be. It's either going to be Romney or it's going to be Hillary.
No.
Because Hillary is a Republican.
No, she's not. She's Democratic.
No, she's a dino.
Right, right. Okay.
She's a Republican, but she wears a Democratic, pin.
Yes. Well, as well as Romney, he wears an R on his lapel. But anyways, the lines have been so blurred so much in the last, I don't know, probably 40, 50 years, as far as I can see.
What do you you have a radio show, you talk to a lot of people. What are the solutions that are being proposed?
Don't send your children to the military.
Well, that's a good one. So if you have a black family and you have barely enough money to eat and your kids have struggled to go through some inferior school and they got their high school diploma, now they go out and they look for work and they can't find work, and then the military says, "Hey, we'll give you a job."
I know. I've got two nephews and a niece that went into the military and they're all out right now. But I'm sorry, the one is still in, but. And he's been over to Afghanistan for 9 months.
What does he have to say?
Don't really say much. I don't really talk to him much about it because he's caught in the illusion. And if he comes around, he comes around. If he doesn't, he doesn't. So,
Well, I don't in any way take away from the guys in uniform. I mean, they're told what their job is and they're given a certain reality, which is not the real story.
Yes.
I never blame them. I think it's very courageous of anybody to go into any of these war zones, considering the cards are really stacked against them, it's very courageous of them to do that. The question people need to ask is this how you want your kids to, to spend 2 or 3 years of their life?
And I also think, John, that another solution is going to be a lot of sacrificing. If people will sacrifice and they will even consider it, they can give up two of those three jobs and live off of a two-income family. They just don't need, they just don't need all of these flashy things that a lot of people are seeking.
That would starve the beast, which is a good idea.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. Grow your own food. I mean, people did it for millennia, for thousands and thousands of years up until probably, 60 years ago? 70 maybe?
Yeah.
People were then domesticated into, and I hate the word, but chattel or sheeple.
You're pretty radical.
Yeah, I am. Well, this is internet. This isn't regular FM or TV or anything like that, so we
No,
can be.
but I'm wondering. I mean, I don't think I used to go to Niles. I think I told you this more in our private conversation.
Yes. And I
I
was going
don't
to
think
say
it's
something.
exactly a hotbed of revolutionary activity. How do your neighbors view you? Are you a They whap you on the back, or do they slam their doors and
Most of them
hide when you walk by?
don't even know what I do. I have got more fans and more following in Europe than what I do here in America. Let's put it that way.
Hey, and by the way, anybody that says as an expat somehow, I get this a lot. Oh, you're in Japan. What right do you have to say about what goes on in America? How dare people
Yeah.
say such a thing? I care about my country. I have
That's right.
friends back there.
That's
I
right.
have my daughter lives there and her children, And not only that, I always give this example. Let's take us back. It's 1938, and I'm living in Germany, and I'm a Jew. And I go, wow, things are looking bad here. And I leave the country.
That's
I
right.
become an expat. I'm still a German citizen,
Look at
but
Albert.
I live someplace else. It's my duty to let people in Germany know, hey, you guys are heading down a bad road.
Look at
That's my
Einstein.
duty. It's not like suddenly because I left the country, I can't say
Yeah,
anything.
look at Einstein. He left Germany. So, as did many other dignitaries in academia. They left Germany.
He got out.
Yeah, they were smart enough to figure out that the government wasn't really coming after just the Jews. He was coming after other people too. Hitler, I mean, he come after the people that were smart enough to figure out that it wasn't just going to be the Jews.
The problem now is that America is everywhere.
Yes.
It's everywhere. And so what goes on in America, and especially if it starts a world war, there is no escaping. There's no safe place on the planet from if there's a nuclear exchange. So it's important for everybody to speak out, whether you live in Japan or I have many expat friends. I have a good friend in China. I've got one in the Netherlands. These are all people that have, for largely personal reasons, but sometimes political reasons, have said, I can't take it anymore. I don't want to live there. I don't want to live under this kind of oppressive environment of fear and military, constant talk of, military and war. And, these people, as you say, it's interesting. You say you have more followers from Europe than America. I mean, that makes sense to me because when you're out here, you can look back and kind of see it with a little bit clearer eye. I'm not claiming any kind of superiority or anything like that. I'm just saying you can kind of see things as they are. And things are not healthy there. And America's going down a very dark road. But I ask you again, what is the solution? I mean, we still have something resembling democracy. We have elections coming up in November. Is it going to
Well,
be just the same old pull the lever
yeah,
and
I don't really think we have elections. I think they give us the illusion of elections with our vote. They tell us, well, you can vote for our man with a D on his shoulder here, or you can vote for the man with the R on his shoulder over here, which is both of our men personally. We trained and groomed both of these men, so you have a choice. You can vote for our man with the R, or you can vote for our man with a D.
I say vote for the man with a C, with a
Yeah.
contract between his constituents and him or her that says, when I go to Congress, this is how I'm going to vote on this issue. I'm going to tell, and I'm going to be very frank with you. My idea has not caught fire. I sent 80 books at my own expense. I bought and sent to green parties and independent candidates and movers and shakers, everybody from up.
I'm bringing in a friend. She
Oh,
went,
great.
yeah, she wants to, she wants to grill you about a couple of things.
Okay, I love being grilled.
Are you there, Jill? Hello, Jillian.
Jillian.
Hello, Stephen.
Hi.
Are you British, Jillian?
No, I'm not. I'm of Cornish descent, apparently. I am
Apparently.
of English descent.
But she's in Australia.
Ah, Aussie. Okay, I love Australians.
Yeah, they're good, aren't they?
In my travels, I run into more Australians than any other country.
Really?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, you know, because I'm in Asia. So, like last winter, I went to Cambodia and I went to Vietnam, and Australia's taken over Bali. I mean, if you go to Bali, Indonesia, it's just, you know, 8 out of 9 people are Australians.
Yeah, they totally love it. They totally love it. Hey, listen, you studied philosophy. I suppose you studied Merleau-Ponty and phenomenology.
I did.
Yeah.
Yes.
What did you make of that?
I mean, studying philosophy.
And hang on, I'll add to it because we've only got a few minutes left, I think. And how would you like to compare that to if you've studied in sort of Buddhism? If you studied any Tibetan Buddhism, for example, did you study the Majjhimika Prasangika, or you know, any emptiness sort of doctrines by Geoffrey Hopkins, or you know?
Okay, I'll be very blunt. When I was in university, my study of philosophy was very, very technical. I leaned toward ordinary language analysis, Wittgenstein, people like that. I got only passing familiarity with Eastern philosophy. In my travels, I have done some reading in Eastern-oriented theologies. I find Tibetan Buddhism to be much too iconic. I spent a good amount of time in northern India, northern India, Kashmir, Jammu is effectively Tibet now, because everybody from Tibet, including the Dalai Lama, who I managed to meet while I was there.
Oh, lucky you.
All those people migrated from Tibet as China systematically destroyed their culture.
You've just said something absolutely fascinating, John, because...
I got to warn you, John, because she was a Buddhist back in the 70s.
Okay. Jill
was.
Yeah. But
Kashmir and Srinagar, there's a fabulous Sufi philosopher up there called Hasnat... Oh, I can't remember his name. He's about 90 now. And he's the one who sort of thinks that Moses and Jesus both died in Kashmir.
Right. And there is actually, I think, Jesus' footprint in Srinagar. Yeah. I did see that.
Well, it's not a real footprint, but it's another icon. It's another symbol.
I know.
But it has the crosses. You know, I mean, it has the scars, which sort of, I did a show on it. And I'm absolutely fascinated with that, because I'm of the theory that Jesus said he went to was going to unite the 10 lost tribes of Israel.
Right.
Right. And apparently he did that in Srinagar after he came off the cross, after he survived the cross. And I believe that.
Okay.
I believe it. Especially, and if you've been in Kashmir, and I did notice, you know, that the Dalai Lama was up there. And I think actually Kashmir, which you brought up, might actually, even though it's in a state of incredible unrest at the moment, might actually be a melting pot for something very special in the future, in terms of the realization that all spiritual paths lead to knowing yourself, including Greek philosophy.
And I forgot to mention also, John, that she's a show host. She has a show on the network too.
Okay. I mean, Srinagar is an interesting place because it's 95% Muslim. And I spent 5 weeks there living with a Muslim family during Ramadan. So I got a very intense dose of Islam while I was there. I didn't see the presence, and I was very almost puzzled by what you're talking about, because there's a small shrine to Jesus, and they talk about you know, his presence there and his effect on the local community. I don't see any immediate impact because Islam is really the religion du jour of that area. But,
well, I think Islam needs dismantling too. Like, everything has to be unpacked and deconstructed, doesn't it, for a true practitioner to follow it. And before, when you said, I won't rave on for too long, but I do want to make this point. Before, when you said that, I've forgotten what you said. I do this when I fiddle with too many knobs. Sorry, go on. I'm multitasking here.
I said that these countries, these Buddhist countries, seem to have a social, metaphysical texture, which I find to be very pleasant and very gracious and very accommodating to my, even to my Western mind. I mean, to understand any of these religions, you have to appreciate the fact that they really see the world completely different than you and I growing up in, you know, in the Judeo-Christian, American, Australian environment. And even their languages shape the way that they see the world completely different. And that's something, married to a Japanese woman, that I've had to try to accommodate. I mean, literally, our communication problems are not linguistic. They're fundamental in terms of our perception, as you say.
Well, this is why I brought in Merleau-Ponty and phenomenology.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah. So I really think that, you know, if in schools children were taught more philosophy, and, you know, what are you reckon? I can see you smiling there. Yeah. What do you think, John?
No, I think it's great. But, you know, all my life I said, yeah, I have a degree in philosophy. And I either get like the deer in the headlight look, like, what?
What philosophy?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, like Sigmund Freud. No, that's psychology.
it was psychiatry.
Or theology. So you're a priest, are you?
So, no, I think, and people say, why did you go into philosophy? And I always say, well, why didn't you go into philosophy?
Yeah.
What did it prepare you for? And I said, it prepared me for everything.
Yeah, it helps you deconstruct.
Say, Jill.
It helps you deconstruct and reconstruct, and it helps appreciate the larger view of things, the larger issues. Did it prepare me for anything in particular? No, I can't write computer code as a result of having a degree in philosophy. But it does allow me to appreciate the place that computers and cybernetics and AI and so forth plays in the larger scheme of the larger fabric of human knowledge. Yeah. So, you know, to each their own. But I'm trying to imagine them actually teaching philosophy in public schools. That would be interesting.
We're doing it in Australia, I'm actually about to start a dip ed to teach philosophy and psychology in schools, because that's all I'm qualified to teach.
Well, okay, that's a good reason for teaching. I'm glad that you didn't study auto mechanics, you know.
Well, I just wanted to get hold of some captive audience, you know, with young minds that I could bend and sort of explode a little bit. And then when I looked at my subjects, they said, oh, well, you can teach psychology and you can teach philosophy. And we do have philosophy classes at our local school here too.
But Jill,
I think kids would love it. I mean, yeah. Kids are very, especially young kids, are very, very, you know, their minds are open and they're like sponges. And to be able to offer them something that is not necessarily directly attached to a job title is breathtaking in a way. But I don't think that's what the powers that be want. They want us to be worker bees. They don't want us to be thinker
bees.
That's
right. They want us to just be smart enough to push the papers and push the buttons on the machines.
But Jill,
sounds like he'd be an interesting guest for you.
Yeah, he would be an interesting guest for me, John Rachel.
Except you know a lot more about philosophy than I do. That was a long time ago.
I don't know anything. Like, I don't even know what Heidegger was saying. Like, half the time, I think they stole a lot of it from Eastern religion. Well, I know they did. Hume, all of them. They were all informed by ancient saints, and so they should be. But they could accredit it a bit more rather than think they were just their own philosophy. You know, it was their own. You know, a lot of it is just completely stolen.
Well, we say
not stolen. I mean, that's how life is, isn't it? Like, we get our information from other people.
Well, and that's how it should be. You know, I mean, I would love to see Christianity return to its fundamental messages. You know, I mean, you turn on the TV and you see mega churches with the minister pulls up in a limousine.
Yes.
You know, and he's covered. He's got his Rolex and he's got diamonds. And excuse me. I don't remember this in the Bible. Is there something about limos and then supporting wars? Is there something in the Bible about bombing ISIS that you want to talk about? And yet they do. They actually
are bombing the Middle East. Yeah.
But you know, I think it's absolutely fascinating, and I think it's terribly important because people are so interested in religion or spirituality, or of course, you know, we have the innate questions that we ask. And then if we can marry philosophy and psychology. See, I started started off doing social work at university, and I had huge fights with my lecturers because I was so left of field. I ended up going, well, I'm just going to study what I love. And so I ended up with a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology and Humanities.
And what school was that? Where was it?
Oh, just at university, a local university.
Yeah.
In Australia, in Melbourne. It was called University of Ballarat, but it's now actually called Federation University. It's changed its name.
Okay.
But anyway, the point being that I think, you know, a proper education, or what was considered, you know, a classical education, is an education where you study logic and reasoning and ethics and how to deconstruct things and to get wisdoms from ancient teachings. And in Australia, anyway, thank goodness, we are headed a little bit more towards that at the moment.
Great. That is encouraging to hear. Seriously.
Yeah. And that's a pretty good note to end on, Jill and John.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for coming on too, Jill.
Yeah. No, it's my pleasure. Okay. So I'm actually waiting to chat to somebody else too. So not on air. So Stephen Roberts, thank you so much for having me on Cancel the Compile.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
And John Rachel, lovely to meet you and hear your wonderful stories.
Did you send him a contact?
Keep in touch.
Did you send him a contact yet, Jill?
Oh, I will. Okay. Thanks. I will.
All right, everyone. I had originally asked John to do 2 hours, but then somebody during the week there asked me if I could help him. So we only decided on 1 hour.
Okay.
And John said that was fine with him. He's going to go get his morning bicycle ride.
I got to do my bicycle
ride. Or go through the village.
It's a difficult life.
Yes.
Anyway, listen, if you want to do this again sometime, I'd certainly be open to it. I know I rattled at the mouth. I'd like to hear more of your ideas and some of the things that your guests have to say.
Oh, certainly.
These are solvable problems.
Certainly.
We need to get out of our lazy boys and do something. That's all.
The number one solution, I think, John, is taking back our sovereignty, taking back our own personal powers.
Exactly.
Taking back our rights.
Right. All right.
So, yeah.
Peace, brother.
Yeah. As we go to war to Iraq for the third time. Yeah. Peace.
Yes.
All right.
And probably Syria, then Iran, and Russia and China.
Maybe Scotland.
Just blow a few more arms and legs off people and leave them writhing in agony.
Yeah.
Ugh.
All right, everyone. That's the end of my show here. I've got to go. So thanks, everyone, for coming out. I'll just sign off and you two can talk for a couple minutes if you'd like. But I'll be back on Friday. I have a very, very special guest on Friday. I've got a retired Army general, and I'm not going to say anything more than that. She's going to come on and tell us some things that we already know, and maybe she's just going to solidify our beliefs. But she'll be coming on along with someone else. I'll have two guests on that night. So thanks, everyone, for coming out, and I will see you this Friday.